I struggle with walking the line of being an artist and a human, like outside of battle rap. Like I'm just trying to keep my humanity most of the times. I know that I've created a space for people to have preconceived notions about me. I'm cool with that. I just want them, when I show them who I really am, though, I just want them to listen to that. Like, I want them to be as receptive to that as they are to the idea of who they think I am already. So I think with this project, it'll do that. Like, I think more people will walk away knowing Marvin as opposed to Marv One, and that's kind of what I wanted. What's going on, people? It's your favorite fat guy, Marv One, or the world famous Fat Killers, Detroit's own East Side. Y'all know I got an album dropping April 5th. I'm fine, thanks for asking. And with that, you know I had to come and talk about it on the Fly Fidelity podcast. Tune in. We're gonna cover everything. Some things you've heard, a lot of things you haven't. It's only right.
First I say, what we gonna do? Then you say, I don't know. What do you want to do?
What we gonna do? What you
want to
do?
I have an idea.
You gonna dig this?
The Fly Fidelity podcast
is the solution.
It's the best.
Check it out.
You wanna get
super fly?
Details just ahead.
Do you love
credible content,
but hate
how long you have to wait?
And who wants
super thick and frothy dumpster juice with rat corpses in it?
There's a better way.
Fly Fidelity.
Fly Fidelity.
Fly Fidelity.
Fly Fidelity.
Fly.
Fly. Fly Fidelity.
Fidelity.
Fly Fidelity podcast.
Fly Fidelity, baby. Fidelity, baby. Fidelity.
With your host, Luke Bailey.
Welcome to the program. This week, we're joined by Detroit underground lifer, Marv One, a dual threat MC producer and one of the most esteemed battle rappers. Strap in for a captivating conversation in which we discuss his journey and forthcoming metal music debut. I'm fine, thanks for asking. Enjoy the conversation.
Yeah, yeah, I'm trying to go, you know. I'm trying to go to the Rock Nation brunch. Hove on the grill, Beyonce making the punch. The yacht's in the back, the little lakes in the front. Put the game on the plate, go ahead and take what you want. I'm trying to go to the Rock Nation brunch. J. Cole on the bar, Rihanna facing the blunt. Linen and limousines that came with the bump. Where big deals get made without saying too much.
I'm curious as to how you would describe growing up in Detroit at the beginning, and what was it about Michigan that was so significant to your identity that informed your range of perspectives as an artist coming up?
Well, you know, I would say Detroit is like any other urban environment. I think it gets a really bad rap because all people focus on is the negative. But growing up in Detroit, I had one of the best times in the world. You know what I'm saying? Like, it definitely taught me to be mindful of both my surroundings and people, you know, that I hang with. But it also instilled like a real like hunger in me for the music. Like just being around people who I looked up to, whether it was J. Dillon, Slum Village, or Big Proof, and Eminem, or like anything in that era, like it definitely helped mold and shape who I became as an artist. I don't know if I would be the artist I am if it weren't for the city, honestly.
Right. Now, you mentioned the people you looked up to. Who would have been among some of the earliest artists locally to inspire you to actually want to make music?
It was actually Dilla. I was such a fan of his beats even before I knew who he was, and even before I knew that he was from the city. I just remember hearing Slum Village has a song called "The Look of Love" that is just like, it blew me away. I couldn't believe that people were making music that sounded like this where I was from. So Dilla and Slum Village would be my go-to. I'm also very adamant. I've gone on record saying that I think that Slum Village is the best group to ever come out of Detroit, for sure.
That's fair.
For sure. Yeah.
What was it about J. Dilla that worked for you back then and still works for you now?
Man, it was one of those things where his music had so much feeling. Like, it elicited such like a visceral reaction, like from me, like not even like even on my first time hearing it. You know what I'm saying? Like, it gave me such a feeling. Like it was so pretty, but it was so dirty at the same time. Like, it was just like it does it for me. And then just some of the genius behind it that people still to this day don't even acknowledge, like what he's doing with that machine is super crazy to me. You know what I'm saying? So that's what does it for me. That's what does it for me. It was always what went into it. Like, and I was able, like, it got such a reaction out of me that's why, you know what I'm saying? He's number one, far and above anybody else.
Completely agree. Did you guys have a personal relationship?
So I met Dilla right before he got sick. He was in the process of doing a sequel to an album he did called Welcome to Detroit. He was going to do Welcome Back to Detroit, and I was one of the people that was tagged to be on the next project.
Wow.
So yeah, super, super humbling. So with that, you know what I'm saying? I met him through that. Like, I officially met him through that. I'd seen him out and spoke a couple times, but that was my first official meeting of Dilla. He got sick not too long after. So our relationship was very short-lived, but it was super impactful.
Did you get the chance to hear that beat and write to that beat at all?
Nope. It never even got to the point of, it never got to the point of, all right, here's the idea for y'all. Like, it was just like, okay, I want to do this. I want you to be a part of it. And that was it. That's how that was the extent of it. I wish it would have, for sure.
To this day, that must be surely one of your career's greatest what if stories, right?
Oh, without question. It's definitely, it's not a regret, because I know that it was out of my control.
Right.
But I definitely would have loved the opportunity. I definitely would have loved the opportunity to have that under my belt, for sure. I won't lie.
Money for a Motorola Star Tack when it's time to call back. With a rough, rugged, and raw way, this nigga Jay, it's a game, but he don't play. Ay. For all the chicks that got dead in the penthouse suite on top of my mom's crib. And. It's nonsense you never get in. It's nonsense that you would think that you would ever get in. K. For the cutie crushing that we do, we keep them two. We got two for you.
How did your exposure to your cousin become a bridge for how you thought about being competitive in the beginning?
I mean, well, my big cousin was my, like, he was my introduction into not only Detroit hip hop, but hip hop itself. Like, my cousin was legit my introduction. I didn't have any older brothers, so he kind of like filled the role for me in that sense. So everything that he wanted to do, I wanted to do. Like, I was trying to tag along, like I was trying to be his shadow, basically. So whatever he was into, I was into, just to like try to impress him. And then it really, really like took a hold of me. Like, hip hop itself really took a hold of me. So I remember the first song I ever memorized was Boogie Down Productions, 9mm Goes Bang, and I was on a tape that he had, like a dubbed cassette. So my cousin was my introduction to hip hop in general, not just Detroit hip hop, but I do remember my cousin taking me to shows, taking me to see Slum Village Live. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was
Amazing.
he yeah he was the influence for sure.
So what takes you to hitting stages yourself?
Ego, maybe ego, a little bit of fear as well. But by the time like that, I knew that I wanted to rap, like I wanted to pursue it, like it was my passion. I had met up with my guy Dale, whose rap name at the time was Disaster, and he was producing. And he started a company called Silent Riot. And I just felt like, oh, this is the first person that I've met, like who's actually going to the studio and, you know what I'm saying, has demos of themselves and they sound really, really good. So he took me up under his wing and I really learned a lot from him. So when he started doing shows, I started doing shows because, you know what I'm saying, like I was basically his shadow. I did my first show when I was maybe 15, 16, and I was so nervous that I couldn't look at the crowd. I was so nervous. Like I remember Adele was on stage with me, and I just remember looking at him the whole time. Like I couldn't look out at the crowd. Like I was so nervous. So that was super crazy. That was a super crazy time. But now it's my home. It's my first home. It's not my second home. The stage is legitimately my home. Like that's where I feel the most comfortable. Like, period, is on stage.
You mentioned the word fear. How did you, in those moments, learn to turn that fear into confidence?
Repetition. Repetition, you know what I'm saying? Or getting through it, and then afterwards, someone coming up to you and saying that they appreciated your performance, or they got the message that you were trying to convey. And then you start the idea of like, yo, I need to start connecting with these people, so I owe them to look at them at least. And it went from being fear to being a rush. Like it went from being fear to being like addictive. Like it's really addictive being on stage for sure. Super addictive.
What would have been a moment that you started to realize that people were fearing you, fearing what you did lyrically?
I guess when I started getting so there was an open mic here in the city of Detroit called The Lush, and it was like where all of the who's of that time went. And one of the people who had a super heavy influence on me, his name Guilty Simpson, one of my favorite rappers of all time. And I remember I rapped. And Guilty came up to me after I rapped and was like, yo, man, you good. And that just felt that was the biggest sign of approval that I could have ever wished for. You know what I'm saying? Because Guilty was that guy. Like Guilty was the dude for me. So to hear him say that he fucked with what I was doing, that definitely made me poke my chest out a little bit, like a little bit further. Like I
Completely
like so I like
validates it.
I yeah, you know what I'm saying? Like I've had people come up to me and show me love. But someone that I genuinely looked up to being like, hey, like I'm like I rock what you're doing. Nobody could tell me anything after that. I just knew I was the best thing since sliced bread, for sure.
What about battles in terms of you getting out there, building a reputation and battling people? Who were some of those opponents within that period? And what do you think was the legacy of that time in your journey from a battle rap space?
I mean, well, I feel like everybody starts in the same spot. You know what I'm saying? Like we all battle in your neighborhood, or you battle in your high school lunchroom, or something like that. Like you try to battle to prove your worth and dominance. So then, once you get out of that stage, then you go to other people's neighborhoods. You start going to other people's high schools. And once you get out of that, then you start going to the spots where everybody where everybody congregates. And then you start trying to test your sword there. For me, when I was coming up, Detroit has such a huge history of producing battle MCs. Like, a lot of us, like, were really, really, like, good, from the West McCody's to the Midwest Miles to the X Factors, Mo Dirty. Like, it was so many of us. Swan. At that time, Swan was probably the ceiling. For sure. He had gone out. He had won, like, Scribble Jam. Like, he had done MTV, like, all that stuff. So Swan was probably the ceiling. And all of the people here were so good that when I was going out of town and, like, battling people, like, it felt like a letdown because they weren't as good as the people that were back home. And I'm not even saying that with bias. Like, I'm saying, like, I would go places and be like, oh, you're not as scary as Fat Ray. You know what I'm saying? So,
yeah,
I got you. You know what I'm saying? Like, I always say, and I catch flack for it sometimes, but I feel like Detroit breeds the best technical rappers in the world. Like, New York started it, I give you credit. LA controlled it, I give you credit. The South controlled it. But if you put on a beat and you just tell people to rap, people from Detroit, in my opinion, will always come out on top. Legit. Like, they always gonna win. Like, I feel like it the only thing that changes is the content. Like, but the rap itself, can't nobody mess with us, bro. Nobody can mess with Detroit rappers at all.
What Detroit did was really elevate this measuring stick, didn't it? Really pushed the bar.
Definitely. Like you're in a space where on any given night you can hear Big Proof, or you can hear Elzai, or you can hear Royce da 5'9", or Obi Trice, or Miss Corona, or King Gordy, or Guilty Simpson. Like, we had an abundance. We have an abundance of top tier rappers. Like, and like, there was a time where when you told people you were from Detroit, they just automatically assumed that you were an incredible rapper, because 9 times out of 10 you were. Like, even our so-called street rappers were incredible. Street Lil Wayne, or Cheddar Boy Malik, or Stretch Money, like Big Hurt. Like, we all come from the cloth of being able to rap really, really well. And that's because of our environment. That's because of where we're from. Legit.
For the season, them leaves fell and I moved it through your region. The few who are believing, salute, you are the reason. So it's you who I'm appeasing. Winter wars, my new shit is freezing. It's fresh out the wrapper and brand new. I'm fresh, I can make a rapper sound brand new. At best, if I wasn't me, I'd...
We never looked at ourselves as the underdogs. We always knew we were better than everyone else. Like, we just needed a door to be kicked in. And, you know what I'm saying, like, Eminem kicked in the door for a lot of people here. So we never felt like we were underdogs. We always knew, like, okay, the second they hear us, it's going to be over. It's going to be over for them, for real.
Now, you're also recording music as well as battling back then. Tell me about those nuances between writing songs and navigating a battle space during those, you know, pivotal years of you growing as an artist. What was that progression like between making music and you stretching yourself in a completely different capacity as a battle rapper?
So the biggest takeaway with battling and music is, I felt with battling, you're giving the crowd what they want. With music, you're giving the crowd what you want them to have. Music is very, very, it's very cathartic for most of us. You know, a lot of us have traumas that we're not able to go to a therapist about. And for a lot of us, the booth is the next best thing. So I always felt I always felt that being an artist was more of who I was as opposed to the battling. I battled because I was good at it. I really worked at being an artist. Like, battling came easy. As an artist, I really, really worked at it, and I honed my craft, and I was very blessed to be able to create with such creative people. Like, being in a group with King Gordy and Bang Belushi and Fat Father, and we were the Fat Killers. Like, that was boot camp for me. Like, as being an artist, that was really boot camp for me, because I knew at any given time, any of the people in my group could make me irrelevant on a song. So I had to work to be a better artist. That's where more of the vulnerability came from being an artist as well. Like, when you're battle rapping, like, everything, like, you're always larger than life. Like, you always make it like you're better than the next person. In music, sometimes you got to take a look in the mirror and be like completely transparent, if that's the kind of artist you are. And that was the kind of artist that I've always wanted to be. So that's what I worked at. So that's the difference. The parallel was, one was fast food and one was home cooking.
You mentioned the Fat Killers. Take me through the conception of the Fat Killers. What was the tipping point for starting the Fat Killers? Which happens, you know, at the tail end of the late 90s, early 2000s?
Yeah, early 2000s, maybe 02, maybe 02, 03. What happened was is that I had a mentor named Big Cobb, RIP. He also gave me my rap name. But I had a mentor named Big Cobb, who was like the front man for a group here called the Teamsters, in which Fat Father was in the Teamsters. And so, like, he would basically, like, come around and, like, mentor, like, young rappers coming up in the city. So it'd be like Moo, and there was an artist named Ek, there was an artist named Il Uno. And, you know, like, we would ride around and, like, soak up game. So I became really cool with Fats. Like from almost like instantaneous. And we're standing outside the Lush one night, the same open mic that I was talking about. And by this time, I had kind of ingratiated myself into the community. You know what I'm saying? Like, I wasn't necessarily, I wasn't looking for conversations or anything like that. Like, I was a part of the community. So we're standing outside the Lush and we're joking around. And he says, "Man, you know what? You fat. I'm fat. You a killer on the mic. I'm a killer on the mic. We should be the Fat Killers." And it started, you know, we laughed. And Cobb was like, "Yeah, man, come on, let's do a song." So Gordy at that time was one of the people that Cobb was mentoring. So he was just like, you know, it makes sense. Let's just do a song. And we did a song, the three of us, and we couldn't come up with a hook for it. And Cobb was like, I know who can do this. He was like, "Yo, it's this kid from this other group called the Lab Animals." And at that time, his name was Shimmy Bango. He was like, "Yo, I'm gonna get Shimmy Bango to do the hook." Bango came in, laid the hook. The song ended up being a joint that we had called Fat World. And it literally, like, just took off. And then we were like, "Oh, it's much easier to write one verse than it is to write four. So let's just do this." And that's legit. That's how it came up. It wasn't a lot of planning. It wasn't a lot of thought. It was like, "Oh, this is easy. Let's do this." And it caught on really, really quick.
Completely organic.
Yeah.
Can you remember your first time being played on the radio and what that moment felt like for you guys, you know, professionally, personally at that time?
Man, so the big thing for me is that, like, a goal of mine, the only thing I really wanted, I just wanted a vinyl. I wanted a 12-inch vinyl with my name on it. Like, that's legit all I wanted. So, like, I that was a measure of success to me. So, in the process, when we came up with the song "Get Your Paper," that was produced by Black Milk, and they started playing it on the radio. Like, and not just like in the local section. They actually started playing it like in rotation. It felt like such it felt like we won. You know what I'm saying? Like it legitimately felt like we won. Like, yo, this is what's gonna separate us from the rest of the people that are trying to do it. Because we're able to toe the line between being lyrical and being easily digestible.
Right.
And they ran that song up. They ran it up. It just felt like such a win, bro. It felt like a win for all of the people who are good rappers. You know what I'm saying? So I definitely remember it. I remember it like, oh, this is real. Like, oh, this is a thing. Yeah, this is a thing.
I love that. You mentioned Proof a couple of minutes ago. What did you learn from watching the way Proof would operate as an artist? How would you describe your dynamic as artists and collaborators and as friends back then?
Well, Proof was definitely the person who instilled in us that no matter the amount of success you may garner, it doesn't give you the right to be out of touch. So Proof was, he was our bridge. He was the bridge from what we deemed as success and still being on the grind, because we would still see him in the same spots. He would still come out, support us, like everything. As a collaborator, it was just like, yo, never stop working, because you never know what's going to hit. Try every idea, because something can hit. Just as a friend, bro, like he was legit a very genuine person, like a very genuine person. He never let success change him. Like he would still give you his last. He was still the person. He was never a representative. Like he was always just himself. And that was always super refreshing. And I always tried to take that away. I always tried to take that away from him.
Do you have any favorite memories, any standout memories of Proof?
So one time, he came to pick me up from my mom's house. I was still living with my mom, and my mom had these hedges in front of her house. And we ended up staying out all night. You know what I'm saying? Had 10 too many drinks. And when he dropped me back off, he ran and jumped into my mother's bushes, like her hedges, and left like a human-sized hole in her hedges. So I remember my mom woke me up, like, yo, what happened to my bushes? I was like, and me being like, you know, in a half drunken state, I was like, oh man, Proof jumped in them. She said, what? I said, yeah, Proof jumped in them. She said, call him right now. So half sleep, I called him. He picked up, like, yo, what up? And she cussed him out. Yo, you too grown to be out here jumping in people's bushes. You know you got too much going on in your life to be doing this. What is wrong with you? You gonna pay to get these bushes fixed? And at the end of it, she gave me back the phone. And he was like, man, you told on me? I was like, well, I'm not getting in trouble for this, bro. I still gotta live here. So that's the moment that sticks out. You know what I'm saying? Like, of course, all the advice he gave me. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, of course, like all the nights he let me work in his spot. Like everything, like Proof really, really held me down. He doesn't get enough credit for what he did here in the city of Detroit for hip hop. Legit. He was the mayor, for real.
Music, what do they think that music is?
I let you niggas live. Be respectful of a kid, baby boy. A Melvin will be having breakfast at your crib. Got a double barrel shotgun directed at your ribs. Marv's a part of Sparta. Fuck you and the message that you give. Teaching lessons with a shiv. Get this bar work. I'm judging niggas with a madman. This is Star Search. Before you take a swing at me, please be up to par first. They think the whip was Scottish. All they know is that the car skirts. You'll get killed trying to take a charge in front of Big Will. The mops did come out and treat your blood like it was spilt milk. Stop the crying, now your woman wrapped up in a silk quilt. Because the foundation you were standing on was ill-built. And I'm in the real estate of being one of them ones. Went from dreaming of Dilla breaks to being over them drums. You nothing more than gorilla bait. They threw you over for fun. The tough talking debility.
When you look back on, you know, those consequential years of building a reputation yourself as a battle rapper back then, what are some of those lessons that left a lasting value and impact on how you navigate and think about the world as an artist today?
I think the biggest thing it taught me was to, you know, to be unbothered. Like, if it's something that I feel strongly in, if it's something that I feel strongly about, don't worry about how anybody else sees it, how anybody else views it. It definitely gave me tough skin. Definitely helped me develop tough skin. So that's the biggest thing that I take away from battle rap. Like, I don't take things as personal as I probably could.
Let's talk about the new album. Can you talk about this album, this journey going into this album, which drops, I believe, next month, April the 5th, if I'm right in saying that?
April 5th. It's called I'm Fine, Thanks for Asking. It's coming out through Mellow Music Group. I'm super ecstatic about it. I think it's my best body of work to date. Self-produced. Did all the beats along with my man Maestro Williams from Silent Riot. Have some really good features on there. Fat Father, Elzai, Freeway, rapper Big Pool, Monica Blair. Like, I got some. I'm super happy. I can't wait for the world to hear this. I'm super humbled that the people over at Mellow Music heard it and thought that it would be a good fit for all of the classicness that they're putting out. We're like three singles deep. We're three singles deep into it. April 5th, man. I'm gonna put myself in the conversation for album of the year, without question.
I've heard the album, and it does feel like it's an accumulation of everything you've experienced and everything you've worked towards up until this moment. Where do you think this album sits with your back catalog?
I think by far it's the best body of work I've created. I know people are very, very partial to Soundtrack of Autumn because it was really the first time that a lot of people heard me by myself, which is cool. And I do think it's a great project, but I feel like this one is the one that they're going to put in the time capsule. If it's for me, this is the one they're going to put in the time capsule. This is the one.
Yeah. What do you think you've learned about making this album, and what rules about writing music and recording have you shed along your journey as a natural progression to get to this point?
I think I'm still learning. I'm still learning transparency. I'm still learning. How I don't always have to be the guy on top, you know what I'm saying, when I'm writing songs. So I think that's one of the big things that I've really taken away from in the writing of this project. As far as like recording and for like producing, like I do it at myself, like I do it at the house. I've been very, very blessed to be around some people who work incredibly in the studio. So I've taken a lot of things from Royce. I've taken a lot of things from Mr. Porter, and just implementing them into my own setup and workload. And I feel like this is the culmination of all that. This is the culmination of it.
I wanted to ask you about how the album opens up with what feels like it does seem to be a direct response to those ripple effects of you being everything to everyone everywhere. What kind of space were you in mentally for the making of this album, and to what extent did those feelings and experiences shape the making of these songs specifically?
So the intro itself, I was overwhelmed, and that's what that is. Like that's what those voices were. Like, it's what I hear all day, you know what I'm saying? So I was very lucky to be able to convey it in that space, and in none of those thoughts or in none of those voices and none of those questions were any of the questions about me. And that's kind of how I felt my life was going at the time when I started writing this project. It just felt like everybody's taking. And nobody is asking me, like, not even a simple, like, yo, how you doing? Like, you good? Like, it was never that. So that's kind of what it felt like. This album just felt like when it started coming together, it just felt more like, I don't need the gold chains for this one. I don't need the expensive alcohol. I don't need the expensive Jordans. Like, this is every day. This is the man every day. This and that's true. What I wanted. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? That's what I really wanted to get across. But yeah.
There's a line on the first song where you say something to the effect of, it's a full-time job to make sure the mask fits. Do you ever struggle with walking this line between battle rapper and artist and, you know, this larger-than-life perception that people have of Mav 1? How do you manage that publicly, and how do you manage that personally?
Yeah, I struggle with walking the line of being an artist and a human, like outside of battle rap. Like, I'm just trying to keep my humanity most of the times. I know that I've created a space for people to have preconceived notions about me. I'm cool with that. I just want them, when I show them who I really am, though, I just want them to listen to that. Like, I want them to be as receptive to that as they are to the idea of who they think I am already. So I think with this project, it'll do that. Like, I think more people will walk away knowing Marvin as opposed to Marv 1. And that's kind of what I wanted.
How do you balance, you know, pleasing your audience with challenging them? Is that a challenge to you?
I realize what my audience is. I realize my appeal isn't to the 19, 20-year-old college student who's trying to get somebody to buy him alcohol so he can go to a party. That's not what my fan base is. My fan base is the person who's seen some life, been through it, took some L's, came back. So I think it's very easy for me to speak to them because I'm going through the same things they're going through. You know what I'm saying? So I don't have an issue. I don't really have an issue with challenging my audience because I feel we're growing at the same pace. You know what I'm saying? So the things I say, they can relate to. So I don't think I have that issue.
I'm looking at the sunrise while the laces of my life being untied. Early 40s, still rapping and I'm unsigned. A refugee to real life, I need one time. The feeling got me living in my head in small confines. Scared I'ma be a body that they come find. The ladder's out of my reach, it's such a dumb climb. Chilling like a villain with my demons coming unwind. Looking at the time that I wasted. Living with my mama, I would cry in a basement. Life is really testing me, I'm dying to ace it. Just trying my patience. Looking at a dream, I'm finally tired of chasing. It's amazing, I done said it before. I think the time's come to be a regular Joe. Promise to not look back once I head for the dough. It's taking up too much space, so I'm letting it go.
Niggas talk about the bottom, I seen it. Hold the weight by my shoulders, I'm beaming. All a nigga really need is the good things. I ain't trying to be greedy, just want the good things. Niggas talk about the bottom, I seen it.
Is there a song on this project that's closest to a snapshot of where your life is right now?
The closest snapshot would probably be the song with Quelle Chris, Good Things, the last single we just dropped. That was actually one of the songs that I was really apprehensive about letting people hear. Really? So I definitely have songs that I create simply for myself. And those are just to get certain thoughts just out, like out of me.
Right.
And that was one of them. I was very, very apprehensive about letting people hear that song just because it is so vulnerable. It is very, like, it's very bare bones. Like, it's really no fluff behind it. But I do think that's the one that is very, very representative of where I am in my life or where I was when I created it, for sure.
And the hook is so perfect. Such a complimentary piece of the track.
Man, Quelle is so good, bro. He's so good.
So
he,
good.
He came in there and knocked that hook out in 5 minutes.
Wow. How did that come about?
Well, Quelle's my man. Like, Quelle's legit. Like, he's always been one of my favorite artists. Him and another rapper from the city named Denmark Vesey, they make up a group called Crown Nation. And I think Crown Nation is one of the best groups to ever come out of the city. So, like, Quelle has included me on a couple of his projects, which I'm super humbled about. And I just felt like I wanted his energy on the project. Like, I wanted his energy on the project. That's what I wanted. And then, you know, I guess I can, you know, kind of drop the bomb here. Me and Quelle are currently working on a project together.
Yeah. Incredible.
So it just kind of worked itself out.
Who's producing that?
Quelle is. He's producing it.
Nice. Yeah. Let's talk about yourself producing. Do you make beats daily or is it like a spur of the moment thing?
So that's one of the only things that I've had a problem with the balancing is being a rapper and a producer. I try not to force it. When it hits me, I don't have a set time,
right,
where I say I'm going to make beats. Like if I feel the inspiration, then I'll definitely make beats. But I try to make beats as I feel them, as opposed to trying to do it out of necessity. So I don't make beats every day. No, I probably should. I should make them more than I make them, but I don't make them as much as I should.
When you listen to this album as a body of work, how do you reflect on some of these older beats throughout your career versus this production? Was there a moment that you noticed your production sort of starting to level up?
I think my production has become more complete. There may have been beats that I liked more that I made, but I understand where these beats are coming from. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
So I love the evolution of my production. And then, you know, a lot of people don't even really know I make beats like that. So that's super funny. But yeah, I'm super excited about where my production is right now.
Let's talk about Rock Nation Brunch, which is the second song you've produced for Free Ray recently, the first one being a track which Beanie Sigel features on. How does Rock Nation Brunch come about? What's the story behind that?
So honestly, bro, selfishly, I just want to be invited to the brunch. I just want to go. I feel like it is a win. I feel like it's a win for not only the hip hop community, but the Black community to see so many successful Black men and women sharing and celebrating each other. And I just want to go. I want to get fly and go. And it's very, very, it's super humbling. Just because I am cool with Free, like we have an actual friendship, like outside of music. And he actually wasn't my first choice of someone to put on the song. I actually wanted it to be Jay Electronica. I wanted Jay Electronica on the song. But after I made the beat and put my verses down, I was like, man, this really don't sound like this don't sound like Jay. I just don't sound like Jay Elect. And I forgot, I don't know if someone mentioned it to me or someone suggested it, but I do remember like, yo, this sounds like Free. And I asked him and he definitely blessed me. He got it back pretty quick too. Got it back pretty quick. And it just made so much sense. Like when I heard it like all together, like it just made so much sense.
What can you tell me about Grand Piano?
Man, so Grand Piano is probably the second deepest track on the album to me. And I kind of like when I was coming up with the idea for it, because like what I'll do is I'll come up with an idea for a title before I come up with the song. Mm-hmm. So like I'll have all my titles. And when I came up with that one, I just knew I wanted it to be a roller coaster. So that's why I started off with my very bare bones hook, and I was super lucky to get my man Nate Curry out of California to do the next one. I'm a huge fan of him, and I was super lucky to get my man Nasaga, who's really known for being a battle rapper, but he makes some of the most incredible music I've ever heard. I was really, really blessed to be able to get him to do the third iteration of the hook. And it just, it felt like the end. Like, it felt like the cap. Like, it couldn't have been anything after that. You know what I'm saying? Like, it felt like, okay, this is the period of the sentence that I was trying to convey. But that's the one. That's the one. I love that song.
Hove on the grill, Beyonce making the punch. The yachts in the back, the little lakes in the front. Put the game on the plate, go ahead and take what you want. I'm trying to go to the Rock Nation brunch. J. Cole on the bar, Rihanna facing the blunt. Linen and limousines that came with the bump. Where big deals get made without saying too much. We up.
When you think about, you know, those standout battles over the last 20 to 25 years, are there any battles in particular that hold a special place in your heart personally? And what kind of impact do you think they ultimately had on a culture at large?
So the first one that comes to mind is the battle I had with my man Pat Stay, RIP. I think just because it took battle rapping to the absolute brink, to the brink.
Push the limits.
It took it to the brink. And us being able to come back from it, you know what I'm saying, show people that cooler heads can always prevail. You know, it doesn't necessarily always have to end in an uproar. I think that's the one that stands out. I also think me and Quest versus Chess and Steams on URL stands out just because nobody really gave us a chance. Like, you know, we're not necessarily, it's not really we aren't really the bee's knees over there. And for us to go over there and put that work in, really, really, it really stands out. So that's one of them. That's one of them as well. I feel like I got a few.
You definitely do. Another one is the battle you had with Cortez, the URL battle.
Very true. Very true. But you know what though? I think that's more so just because of what me and Cortez, like, we were kind of scapegoats. We were scapegoats in the sense of we were the first battlers in HD. You know what I'm saying? Like, we were the first battle that you could pay for separately to watch. Me and Tez changed a lot of things. Like, we changed a lot of things. You know what I'm saying? Shouts to Tez. He's definitely one of the more underappreciated battlers in our sport, for sure.
Definitely. What are your memories of battling Luna C?
Man, I was really, well, you know, so I was, surprisingly, I was at Lunar C's last battle. I was in London. I was in London when he battled for the last time. I thought he was really good. I think Lunar is very, very funny. I think he's very witty. And I don't think he really missed a step coming back after 8 years. Like, I had no problems in being his comeback battle. I had no problem with that. Like, I kind of that's another challenge for me. Try to take the fan favorites, you know what I'm saying, that I know people are going to, that people are going to cheer for. So yeah, you know, I really appreciated this humor. I really appreciated this humor. It was dope.
Are you optimistic that we could, you know, at some point within the next 5 to 10 years, have a union for battle rap?
Why hasn't that happened? Hopefully, I think the people in battle rap are very short-sighted. And I think a lot of people put themselves in situations where they depend on any crumbs that are offered to them as opposed to knowing what their worth is. And on the flip side of that, I think people are scared of finding out what their actual value is. So if you're going to ask for these numbers and what you can actually generate, I think a lot of people, I think the wool will be pulled from over a lot of their eyes when they see numbers. Hopefully it gets to a point where people understand what their worth is. But then if they find out and it's not what they think, that'll definitely put them in a deeper hole than what they were starting with. So we gonna see. We gonna see.
You know this ain't my season, nigga. It's too hot out here for me, nigga. That's what's up, nigga. I'm at you.
I do it for my niggas. The saints, the shooters and the killers, the movers and the dealers. I make music for gorillas. And not the ones who don't know what they doing with their feelings. How I choose to make a living is the flip of every rule that I was given. Been behooved to make a difference. I refuse to do some slipping. Just making sure I get my stipends without losing my religion. You can have the summer's heat and the winter's cold. I crack the combination to the winter's cold. I put my money where my mouth is. When I smile, it's a hint of gold. I don't know them niggas. Who's friends are those? Who
that? I wish I could show my appreciation for this podcast. I wish I could respond to it somehow or be notified in the future when
Fly Fidelity
updates, because it's so great. But I don't think there's a way I can do any of those things.
Uh-oh. You're wrong.
Subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and SoundCloud, and never miss an episode. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
My peoples, are you with me where you at?